one of the great lessons of brand and or marketing planning is you do it 12 months at a time. You know, the beat of any organization is the financial year, quarterly.
Hello and welcome to BrandTuned, a podcast on brand management that covers trademarks and IP as they're intrinsic to brand equity. I'm your host, Shireen Smith, author of BrandTuned. Writing this led to Byron Sharp's evidence-based research stressing distinctiveness over differentiation, which I largely agree with, though not totally. Hence our tagline, Sharp Branding. In this episode, I ask Mark Ritson some of the burning questions that were on my mind as I was writing my book, specifically around understanding your market and establishing your brand strategy, the U and the E elements of my tuned framework. I asked him about business strategy, positioning, and brand strategy, what he thinks of Byron Sharp's views on differentiation and distinctiveness, whether you can really own a particular attribute, and how is brand strategy dealt with in the type of company Mark consults with. And I also wanted to know Mark's views on brand purpose. I think you'll enjoy this episode. So, Mark, welcome to the BrandTuned podcast. I'm delighted you're here. You may or may not have heard the news about TransferWise rebranding to Wise, but I just love your views about an established brand like TransferWise rebranding. They've rebranded to Wise because they felt that the name limited their expansion plans. What do you think of that move?
That's a massive mistake and worrying because they're meant to know what they're doing. There's very few things that are simple in the world of branding, but one of them is rebranding. You only do a rebrand when you legally or commercially have to. You know, Accenture had to do it because Anderson Consulting wanted their name back. You know what I mean? You only do it when you have to do it. You know, Marathon changed to Snickers because they wanted global alignment and, you know, the UK was sticking out. That made sense too. The reason it's such a dumb move is salience is 70, 80% of the branding game. And by changing your name, you decimate it for many years to come. So, yeah, very silly and very disappointing.
Great. Well, this brings to mind Byron Sharp's findings that brand meaning isn't as important as people.
Jesus, Shireen, that was quick. The Dark Lord is already amongst us and we're only 2 minutes in. Go on then, keep going.
Basically, he says that brand meaning isn't as important as people assume. And I think the reason for this rebrand is just around the meaning. And probably people are not thinking about TransferWise in any way except the name now that it's so established. Do you agree that?
I usually find myself in the same position these days when it comes to Ehrenberg Bass theories. I think they are 110% right in the sense that they are brilliant. I mean, we have to give credit to Ehrenberg Bass. They have disproved or reversed many of the sacred cows of branding. But I feel they always go a little too far rhetorically, despite their scientific claims, and tend to over-egg the omelette slightly. And this is a classic example. You've got to give enormous credit to Ehrenberg Bass to have, first of all, believed and then shown and then persuaded everyone that brand awareness or salience, and they're not quite the same thing, it is not just a gateway variable, it's actually the most important part of the branding construct. But then they just go too far and take too much of a crap all over brand image. It's true that brand image is not as sensitive or as vulnerable as many brand people would have you believe. But I do believe still there are cases where either for a core product reason or a specific brand image reason, there will be damage done to a brand if it contradicts its image. The cliched example that you will remember because of your nationality is, of course, the Gerald Ratner cliched case from 30 years ago, right? When you're selling semi-luxurious jewelry and you say it's crap, clearly that generates salience but also destroys the image.
Sure.
You've got to go pretty, you know, you've got to do that kind of thing. Gillette are the most notable example. Their toxic masculinity campaign generated a shit ton of salience, but also contradicted the very thing that most of its loyal customers thought was part of the brand. Not toxic masculinity, but a masculinity that wasn't necessarily a bad thing. And again, I think, you know, but they're the exceptions. For the most part, what we find is we can be oversensitive about image, and salience is mostly it. And Ehrenberg Bass are correct.
So from your experience of working with big brands, how do you think the trademark dimension would have been dealt with in a case like TransferWise's rebranding? Basically, I ask this because as a trademark lawyer, I think TransferWise is a much more distinctive name, and they're going to have huge problems registering Wise internationally.
Well, for two reasons, Shireen, you're 100% right. For two reasons. First of all, because when you move to Wise, you're entering a world of pain at a global level, you know, because that's going to be owned by a bazillion different companies in different sectors. But second, because, you know, if I don't know how old TransferWise is, but
over 15 years old.
Yeah, in that 15 years, they've marked out a territory which belongs to them in IP terms. And to move to something else, as you know, opens up all kinds of floodgates now. I mean, when you look at, you know, new brand creation, it's hilarious because you have to play around with words or misspell things or put numbers in there, because there really isn't any, both in terms of protectable ID, but also in terms of web rights, there isn't anything left out there. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, again, for those reasons, never mind salience reasons, it's a silly maneuver.
Yeah, well, what I think is that lawyers are not involved sufficiently in a branding process so that people make these decisions and then as an afterthought, it has to be checked and registered. So I just wonder whether when you're working with big brands, they bring in their legal departments or are you not aware what they do?
No, I'm very aware. I mean, there's two answers to that. So the first answer is, in my consulting life, which is quite extensive, I've never been involved in rebranding because I just think it's dumb. So I've never been in the situation, because I literally in several instances have said, I don't do that kind of work. I don't think it's a good idea. Literally, I mean, it's a totalitarian response. So I haven't been in the specific place where a rebrand has happened. I have been in positions where brand names have been created. And in those situations, and I'm not just saying this because you're talking to me, I've said, look, this is the one occasion where it makes a lot of sense to talk to lawyers now and spend a bit of money on them. Because, you know, putting it in brand manager's terms, there's nothing worse than investing 2 years and 5 million quid and a significant amount of company resources into building brand equity, only to discover that the name that you've created is no longer tenable because you didn't check. So, you know, I think that's absolutely, your advice is correct for rebrands and also product naming. I would not have lawyers anywhere near the rest of the branding process for reasons you may or may not want to go into, but in this one area, I totally agree.
Okay, well, that's curious. Why do you think that?
They're useless on strategy and overly conservative and risk averse and get in the way of other things. So the one area where you want them there is to be risk averse and overly litigious and conservative when it comes to naming and doing stuff. That sentiment is correct. But when it comes to everything else, they're an extra pair of underwear that we don't need.
Yeah, okay. I'd love your help to actually understand the interplay between business and brand strategy. in the sort of size of organization you tend to work with, which parties would be involved in business strategy who aren't then involved in brand strategy? And, you know, what extra things do you think about in brand strategy?
Well, I don't know if it's extra. I think it's more elephants all the way down, right? So if you look at a relatively marketing-centric company, I mean, in a cement organization, brand strategy doesn't really matter, right? It's mm-hmm. there, but, you know. But in the kinds of companies I work for, where brand could be 40, 30, more than half the total market capitalization of the company, if you actually run the numbers, brand-centric companies, then, yeah, brand strategy is a major subsequence of the corporate or business strategy. In my world, that means that the CMO is the, or the SVP or whatever the title is, usually the CMO is the only person that has a foot in both camps. So he or she is on the board and he's a party to the actual corporate strategy decision-making. And then he or she turns up, you know, usually at my level with the marketing team to delineate that into a brand or marketing strategy. And they mean the same thing in almost every case. And so what it means is you'll often get quite broad and rough corporate strategy objectives, you know, become number one in the market, break $500 million globally, you know, stop losing money, whatever. And they look very general, but in reality, they hopefully have come out of pretty good strategic thinking. Our job then in the marketing group is to translate that into, so how do we do that from the ground up with the market to align with those more broad corporate goals? So the CMO tends to be the bridge. I don't do, my days in a corporate boardroom are about, I don't know, one a year if I'm unlucky. So it's not where I play. But the minute it comes out of the CMO into the marketing group, we typically have strategic imperatives, which we have to translate into, so what's our brand strategy going to be?
Okay, so wouldn't they look into positioning and do research about the customer segments when they're looking at business strategy, or does that happen only?
Definitely not. That's never happened in the history of corporate decision making, in my experience. Unless there's a merger of brands, unless there's some particular issue which has been raised up to the radar, it's a very disappointing. I mean, I don't want to underplay my role, right? Mm-hmm. So, I have been in quite significant boardrooms for certain short meetings. I have interacted at that very big level on a very limited basis. It's always very, and I try to explain this to MBA students, it's always very disappointing for those who are sort of, you know, 25 or 35, who think this is the zenith of the capitalist machine. I'm going to be with the great athletes of the organization. Of course, none of that's true. By the time you get to the boardroom of any decent-sized company, what you've got are the people that are clever but not intelligent and politically astute, not necessarily managerially gifted. That's what you learn from most boardrooms. There are exceptions, but very few. And marketing really doesn't matter at all at that level. It's very rare. There are exceptions, again, where marketing or customers or anything above a basic net promoter score would ever feature in the decision-making of the company. They're interested in product. They're interested in sales, profit, and then ultimately in share price. And I know it sounds funny, but I mean this, and I'm not speaking from a place of ignorance. The thing about most boards is they're dumb enough to not follow the money all the way to its origin. So they follow it to sales. They follow it from product. They follow it to profit. They just don't go back all the way to the customer itself and how the customer thinks and feels. And I can't explain that, but I can tell you that that's an absolute reality of not every, you know, large boardroom, but most.
Okay, so when you're thinking of a business model for an idea, you'd be looking at product market fit and just generally considering all aspects of your idea. Are you saying that you wouldn't then be doing any research into the market, to understanding the market?
No, I'm saying that at the board level, there would be none of that interest.
I see. Mm.
At the brand or marketing level, sure, we'd be, you know, in most cases, that's where the market research kicks in. So now you're in my territory of where I operate, right? So I've worked for a very large number of very big brands on brand and marketing strategy. And what we would do in that situation is we would, you know, if it's done properly, we divide up brand strategy into three phases. First, a diagnosis, which is research and understanding the market and what's been going on. Then we go to strategy, and then we go to tactical execution. And that 1, 2, 3 triptych is how most well-run brands operate. So diagnosis or research absolutely is the first stage in the process. Even if we're not launching a product, we're just brand tracking, we're just reviewing segmentation, we're creating a new brand plan for the new year, we will always step back and do diagnosis, usually about 3 to 4 months out from the start of a new financial year.
So that's setting the marketing strategy, which might be a shorter term thing than the brand strategy, which I gather is more like 3-5 years.
No, not necessarily. So you're right in the sense that, again, I wouldn't separate brand or marketing strategy. The difference between the two is purely based on organizational structure. So if you go and work for HSBC, they'll have a marketing strategy because they're essentially a branded house. It's just the HSBC brand. So each country has a marketing plan. If you go and work for LVMH, they've got 75 brands. So they have brand plans that all meld together into an overall approach, but it's very much done brand by brand. That's the only real difference. And one of the great lessons of brand and or marketing planning is you do it 12 months at a time. You know, the beat of any organization is the financial year, quarterly. And you plan in 12-month increments. Now, that does not mean, to your point, that you might not have a 2, 3, or 4-year journey in mind, but you eat the elephant 1 year at a time. And the reason is very simple. If you don't do that, I've seen companies with their 3-year marketing plans, and they do a lot of work on year one, and they just extrapolate the crap out of it for years 2 and 3. We don't know what's going to happen in year 2 and 3. We don't know what the segments look like or what the competitive moves are, or indeed what we will have achieved in that year. So you do it 12 months at a time. You don't do it less than 12 months. You know, there's an enormous emphasis on agility at the moment, which is a good thing in some cases, but which can often also stand for hot desking, a lack of organizational structure, and absolutely no strategic plan of any kind. It's good to be agile, but I always say to clients, we first must have a strategy before we can begin to think about being agile around it. So yeah, a 12-month strategy is always the way to go. Though to your point, there can be, you know, a plan to get somewhere in 3 or 4 years, mapping it 12 months at a time.
So when you're considering strategy, you're also looking at your positioning, understanding the business that you're in. How do you square Byron Sharp's point that differentiation doesn't matter and it's only about looking like yourself, distinctiveness? How would you deal with that?
I don't disagree, but I don't agree, which makes me sound a bit like a plonker. But so first of all, I talk about, with my clients, I talk about relative differentiation. And what I mean by that is really three things. I mean, you know, first of all, let's be clear. Sharp is correct. Differentiate or die, owning attributes, unique selling propositions. These are the concepts of people that don't understand what they're doing, which unfortunately is the majority of brand managers. You cannot own an attribute. I've looked at 1,000 data sets, literally, and I'm yet to see any brand own any particular attribute when you control for size.
What about Volvo owning safety for a long time?
It doesn't. That's a managerial.
No, it doesn't anymore.
And it didn't even back in the day. It had And this is my point. It had a relative significant strength in terms of perceptions of safety. But there were other automotive brands, if you control for size, et cetera, that also had good, you know, it wasn't as if we had a 5-point Likert scale, Volvo was a 5 or a 4.6 from the market, and every other brand was, you know, 2.3. The data never looks like that. Now, your Volvo example is a good one, don't get me wrong, and still would be. I've worked for brands that do have a relative advantage on certain attributes versus the competitor set. But that isn't differentiate or die. That isn't only an attribute. That's saying that for these three associations or attributes, we do have a significant perceptual advantage. Now, to achieve that, you must only have a handful of attributes you're focusing on. You have to focus on them for a long time, and they have to be the right ones in terms of your brand and your customer desire and your competitors. And those are big ifs. But yeah, that's why I say, when I say relative differentiation, I mean, first of all, relative to the competition. You are going to have a relative strength if you're Volvo on safety. You're not going to own it. It's not going to be unique to you. Second, it has to be relative to salience. Sharp is correct. The most important thing for Volvo is to come to mind when people think about cars and driving and new cars. And that is much more important than safety, even though brand managers might struggle with that thought. And then finally, it's relative to the other associations that Volvo own. So again, when you atomize these things, as unfortunately sometimes even Eric Berg-Bass do, it's not just about safety. It's about the three or four associations that together we're trying to link together to create, if I can use a fancy word, a gestalt, that all together create something valuable in a category. So Swedishness and safety and a little bit of conservatism, perhaps, an environmental concern, may well be also linked. And I'm making these up, but you get my point. That, you know, when you position a brand, usually, not always, but usually there are three or four things going into that overall position, and they all track off each other.
Could your purpose be an aspect of how buyers are likely to choose you, that, you know, you to stand out?
What, in 1 in 100 cases, your purpose is really your position in the marketplace. In the other 99 cases, it's total hogwash, and it's the wet dream of brand managers who are ashamed to sell things and don't really like going to dinner parties in North London and admitting that they sell coffee or beer or, God forbid, petroleum. So they invent something that makes them sound better. You know, they're helping to change the world. I'm sorry to sound cynical, but it is so pathetically bad. One of the things you learn early from looking at data and brands is that brands are little things. No one gives a shit about them except the brand managers that run them. And purpose is really a big thing. And in reality, what we're seeing with brand purpose is an era of incredible self-obsession from large brands. No consumer gives a damn about what brands think about COVID. That, you know, that tinkling pianos and people looking concerned out of windows, that's the ego-driven nonsense of brand managers who've forgotten that their brand isn't part of the consumer's life. It's just the thing they clean their teeth with every night. And so it's really sad to see at the moment this obsession with purpose. There are exceptions. You know, Patagonia is the cliched one, Ben & Jerry. I really like the work of Dole at the moment, who are, you know, their purpose is to get more fruit into the American diet. That's a great purpose. And there is more to it than just making money. And it's something they can deliver on. But for every Dole, there is, you know, Starbucks, BP, you know, doing nonsensical things, Heineken, that, you know, just don't bear any kind of assessment at all.
So how can a brand take a stand on something, have a point of view and differentiate itself in that way?
Well, it has to start, as it always has done, with what the customer wants. There is a standard framework for positioning which hasn't changed for a century, which is essentially the three C's. What does my target customer want? What can I deliver? And what does the competitor for this particular target customer offer? And I'm looking for things that the customer wants that I can deliver better than or different from the competitive set. And if you can find two or three of those things, you're going to make a shit ton of money, in my experience. And whether that's purpose or position or attribute or image, it really doesn't matter. The goal of positioning within brand strategy is to identify what is it that we want to be associated with. All brand positioning is the intended brand image. If I have three brain cells in my target customer's mind, what do I want these brain cells to contain in terms of a association or attribute? That's all positioning was ever meant to be. We just turned it into some gigantic Herculean purpose-driven pursuit because, unfortunately, most marketers overstate their own importance and the centrality of brands in the lives of consumers.
Essentially, then, if a brand is able to take a stand on something and become known and wanted by buyers, you know, buyers buy, and then the competition move in and offer very similar things, take a similar stand, does that mean you're constantly having to revisit your positioning and tweak it to...
No, it's a good question. No, it's actually the opposite, right? I mean, what it means is you've got to stick to your guns, because ultimately, if you know, there's a great case study right now with COVID-19, right? There are several companies offering relatively similar COVID vaccines, yeah? But Pfizer is winning the battle, not because it has anything different. Its efficacy rates are very similar to a couple of the other vaccines now. It's just that they got there first, they're shouting the loudest, and they've got the spotlight on them. So the reality is, most markets, in my experience, is you get there first, you stake out your territory, you claim those things, and then hopefully you can protect them. Remember that most marketing dollars that are spent are defensive. There's no attempt to grow sales. There's an attempt to defend what we've already got and reinforce the brand that already exists. So the reality is, no, if someone comes into your territory and copies you, the best thing to do is just to continue to be yourself. You know, I mean, I always cite the example of my wife, who's immensely more attractive than I am. She must meet, I would guess, at least a dozen men a day who are more attractive, in better shape, and more attentive than me. And so far, I mean, there's still time, she hasn't left me, because no one can be more me than me. And for whatever strange reason, she seems to enjoy that. So the trick is to be yourself and not to be distracted by others coming in and trying to play your game. It turns out that when others try to play your game, they struggle, because your game was always best played by you.
Okay. So that's interesting, because that suggests you would stick to your positioning. But Jenny Romaniuk was suggesting that you wouldn't hardwire your positioning by choosing a name or tagline, for example, to bed it in. I'm just having trouble reconciling.
No, I disagree with that. I normally agree with Jenny. I think she's very, very smart, particularly on obviously mm-hmm. distinctive assets. No, I think one of the great lessons is absolutely to bed in your name and bed in your strap line and not to mess around with them. I think there's you know, I think there's a terrible tendency of marketers to change and alter and update these things, when in reality the customer hardly notices. So I would absolutely say we are guilty in marketing of changing things too often on a whim, when in reality we should maintain them.
Okay, that's interesting. Well, thank you very much indeed, Mark. Just to finish, I wonder whether you can recommend any resources for people to better understand brand strategy and brand management.
Yeah, it's very self-serving, but it doesn't mean it isn't true. I run the most advanced course in brand management in the world, called the Mini MBA in Brand Management. So I've taught brand management at London Business School, MIT, Melbourne Business School, and various other fine, you know, world-leading business schools. And about 4 years ago, I took that course, and I offer it online every April and every September to anyone. And it's 100% online. You can do it anywhere in the world. And it's better than anything being taught at any business school, offline or on. It just is. And we get a ton of CMOs and senior brand managers from 44 different countries who do the course. And everyone is welcome. And so check it out, Mini MBA in Brand Management. If you mm-hmm. Google that, you'll see my beautiful svelte figure. And we'd love to have anyone on the course in April.
Well, I've signed up to do your mini
MBA. Have you, Shireen? That's MBA. Great. Are you doing marketing or brand? What are you doing, Shireen? Are you doing marketing or brand?
I'm doing the marketing first, but I intend to do the branding, the brand one in September next
year. Yeah, it makes sense. If you can do the two, that's definitely the sequence. Your marketing is very much the core first-year MBA class in overall marketing. It's still pretty advanced, but it's, you know, foundational. And then, yeah, great, because the brand course will be right up your street. You'll love it. And, of course, you, as you may already know, you create a brand plan during the course, and then you run it in a simulation for 5 years, and your grade is your share price at the end of the 5 years. So it makes for some frantic activity, I can tell you, for... when we get to that point. Yeah, people really lose their shit, which is exactly the intent.
Well, I look forward to it. The only issue I have is that it doesn't cover IP, which I'll tell you why it's a problem. It's small businesses, which are like 96% of the market, do not actually understand IP, and therefore...
Agree.
I'm part of the problem.
I don't really understand it either. I mean, my stop response is to send them to people like you, which is no bad thing, but not the greatest thing. I'll do you a deal. Come and do the brand course, and then afterwards, let's debrief and talk about where and how we would add the appropriate content. Because I'm not just saying it; I do genuinely think it's an area where, without us getting into too much deep legal water, it would be great to provide a suitable resource, and you can do it for me, and I'd be delighted to add it. So yeah, let's do that.
Okay, I'm looking forward to it. Well, thank you very much indeed then. Well, clearly Mark is quite a character. He doesn't mince his words and knows what he thinks. I really enjoyed interviewing him, and I'm looking forward to attending his mini marketing MBA later this month. My guest next week is John Williams, who started out as a developer on pioneering special effects software before heading up a small media technology consultancy team at Deloitte. John left to consult independently to broadcasters around the world before founding the Ideas Lab and writing his best-selling books, including his most recent one, F-Work Let's Play. If you've enjoyed the podcast, do sign up to the newly created BrandTuned podcast newsletter, where I'll be sharing tips on how to manage brands, answer your questions, give you sneak previews of upcoming episodes, and ask you about topics you want covered. And you might be invited to do an interview if you've got useful content to share which listeners would want to know. Sign up at brandtuned.com/newsletter. The link is in the show notes.